Next case, Karen Owens versus Calhoun County. Mr. Wade?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honor, the clearest reason that this case ought to be reversed is because of the grant of summary judgment on the Americans with Disabilities Act claim. The evidence in this case is that Ms. Owens, after 14 years of employment as an outstanding teacher, fifth grade teacher, took off in October 2008 to have back surgery and neck surgery. There was no definite time or form as to when she was to return. The principal told her, "We want you to come back when you are completely healthy." She had conversations in January and in February with that principal. The principal has those, and they both gave their versions of it, but essentially they're the same, is which Ms. Owens said, "I got a doctor's appointment on February the 12th, and I'll know then when I can come back, if he's going to release me on February the 12th. That last conversation was on February the 4th. I think that's an important date, Your Honor, February 4th, because they wrote a letter, which they say they wrote it on February the 2nd, saying your leave is about to be up soon. Now they're claiming it's undisputed her leave was over on February 1st, but they wrote a letter, and it's in the record on, it's dated January 2nd, but they say it was written on February the 4th. I'm sorry, February the 2nd. And they say in that letter, your leave is going to be up soon. And then they filed, of course, on February 9th. So taking the evidence in the light most favorable to us, which we are entitled to have it taken, under that evidence, they had told her that you can go on and see the doctor on February 12th and let us know about your return date, but then they fired her on February the 9th. Now, Your Honor, it's very important to know what was going on while she was off during that time. So far as the Americans with Disabilities Act is concerned, what is going on is they were having a cutback. The very first exhibit to their motion for summary judgment is an email that they wrote over to the Benton County School District and asked about what was going on with the plaintiff, with Ms. Owens. Is she, we've heard she's working for y'all or something to that effect. And what she was doing is she was doing free work, what we as lawyers call pro bono work. She was doing some testing for them where she could sit, but she was doing free work over for the Benton County School District, and they put in that email, "We're going to have a cutback, and we want to know what's going on over with you, and what work is she doing for you?" Now, she was not being paid. She was doing this trying to help out the school district because she's a tester, and she was helping them with some of their testing. They also point out that while she was on leave, she attended some teacher educational meetings, some things she has to do to keep her certification. But then they fired her on February the 9th, and the reason they're giving now is, well, you weren't able to come back to work, and you wouldn't give us a definite date as to when you were coming back to work. So, Your Honor, these are fact issues. Their defenses are essentially circular. They're saying, on the one hand, well, you couldn't work. You never got a doctor's excuse, and you couldn't work. And on the other hand, they're saying, we're firing you because you were doing work for these other, you know, you were going to the seminar. And you are also working over at the Benton County School District. So their defense is circular. They have some other, you know, factual defenses where they say that she was planning on leaving anyway, and there's evidence in the record that her husband had a job from out of state and she was given consideration to leaving. She explained in her deposition that she would never have left during the middle of the school year. They fired her during the middle of the school year. As it turned out, her husband didn't ultimately get the job, and she couldn't have left, but there is discussion about it in the record where she was talking about her husband having a job from, you know, out of state. But Your Honor, to me, this is a classical, the ADA prohibits discrimination against a person on the basis of disability. There's no question that she has a disability, especially under the new amendments. I think the amendments are very important in this case. But the amendments to the ADA, there's no question that she had a disability. And there's no question that they discriminated. They let off one teacher from each elementary grade. There were four fifth grade teachers. They chose her for the layoff. So they discriminated in favor of the teachers who did not have a disability. That is a classical discrimination when they choose the teacher who has a disability. And to me, their defense is itself related to disability because they say, well, one reason we fired you is you exceeded your time under the Family and Medical Leave Act. According to them, she only had to February the 1st to get back to work. Well, why do we even have an FMLA problem here in the first place? Because she has a disability. She's having back and neck issues. So, Your Honor, essentially...
What did she ask, though? when she thought she might be coming back or when she would be back, and they never got an answer?
Well, Your Honor, that's their side of the facts of the case. What she says is that I told them that I'm seeing the doctor on February the 12th, and I'll let you know then. And at that time, the principal said, well, that's okay. You can see the doctor on February 12th. And then the superintendent is the one that fired her on February 9th. That conversation occurred on February the 4th. But the superintendent then fired her on February 9th after having written the letter on February, according to them, wrote the letter on February 2nd and said your leave's going to be up soon. But it's all a factual issue. What they're claiming, Your Honors, I understand it. They're claiming, well, she wasn't able to work. We think there's a factual question about that. And then they're saying, on the other hand, you were working doing these other jobs. And
so she said, I'm going to see my doctor in a few days, and I'll get back to you after I
yes,
hear what my doctor
has. She also said, I feel sure he's going to release me. I feel sure, you know, she's made some statements about her condition and said, I feel like he's going to release me. Your Honor, they put a lot of weight on the doctor. In fact, they attached to their record excerpts some medical records and say, well, the doctor never had released her. Well, Your Honor, the jury knows, and just, you know, we know this happens all the time. Factory workers go to the doctor and say, you got to release me. I'm going to get fired. That happens all the time. The doctor didn't know anything about that. He just had not given her a release date, but that doesn't mean he couldn't have talked her into, you know, she said, I would have done anything to, you know, to get back if I knew they were fixing to fire me. So that just all raises factual questions. Your Honor, one of the things to me that I think is clearest about this case is Judge Mills spent just worlds in his opinion, it's quoted in my reply brief, resolving credibility issues. You know, for example, he said, he finds it very credible that the superintendent couldn't be out a teacher this long. Well, whether that's credible or not was up to the jury, but the way they handled it, the way Judge Mills' credibility finding is not right because they just put a substitute teacher for her. They didn't bring back a regular teacher. They just didn't replace her. And there's testimony from the superintendent about the problems he was having with the substitute. He said they were getting complaints by one of the substitutes because he talked over their heads and they couldn't understand what he was saying. But they kept a substitute on. They didn't ever replace her. So it didn't do them any good. You know, they just still kept a substitute. So the question is, and the fact question is, was it reasonable for them to, could they not have reasonably accommodated her by giving her a few more days or let the doctor give a reason or let her, as she suggested, sit or lie down some while she's teaching? So those things were factual questions. Your Honor, looking at this case, I just read a law review article that said, and I can't tell much about it except this, or what I thought was so true. It said now in federal court in civil cases, we don't have trial by jury anymore. We got trial by motion. That's about what we have. And this case to me is an illustration of that. These were factual questions that a jury should consider. And to me, of course, when you bear in mind a disability discrimination is not like race, sex, or age, where you got to treat everybody exactly the same. You discriminate against the disabled by failing to give reasonable accommodations. And to me, a jury could have found they discriminated against her. They preferred to have those teachers without keep the other three teachers on without a disability. And to her, so that was, it is classical discrimination, and it was a jury question. And second, Your Honor, if not, when I don't mean to be critical of Judge Mills, it's certainly not my intent, but when he says, I can understand why a school district would want a teacher back and they can't afford to have one out for this long. Well, the trouble is Congress, especially when they passed the ADA Amendments Act, as a matter of public policy, has favored the disabled. You know, technically, I guess the economy might be better off if we didn't have an American Disabilities Act to be more efficient if we didn't have any such thing as that. But the fact is Congress has passed it, and they're to be given reasonable accommodations and a reasonable chance at the job, and this issue should, the issue of whether they could have reasonably accommodated her or allowed her to come back to work should have gone to the jury.
Well, did her doctor release her? I mean, was she ready to come back to work?
Your Honor, they're going to point out that in March, he had still not released her. There's a medical record. But after she's fired, there's no reason for him to request a release. She testified that she could go back if she was allowed to sit some or possibly to lie some, and she would have done it. She testified, if they would have given me a chance to try, I could have done the job with some reasonable accommodation like that if they'd given me a chance. And all she was asking was to see the doctor on the 12th. They didn't say, no, if you don't come back today on the 4th. The principal didn't say, well, you come back today or you're fired. When she told her I got a doctor's appointment on the 12th, that was okay with the principal. And as it turns out, she was fired on the 9th before the doctor even had the appointment. But it wasn't, there wasn't any occasion for her to say, you know, I've got to get a release so I can go back to work because she's already fired. So these were, I just say in all respect, Your Honor, it should not be up to the district judge to determine whether this is sound public policy to have an ADA or whether the school district would have been better off economically to stick with the non-disabled teachers. The issue should have gone to the jury on whether she was discriminated against on basis of disability. Your Honor, the second issue, if the court please, I'd like to discuss with the court is a prerequisite to our First Amendment claim. One of the reasons, and I think it's the first reason as discussed in the brief for dismissal of our First Amendment claim, was that I did not put the word 42 U.S.C. 1983 in the complaint. You know, I said it's under color of state law, they violated the constitutional rights to free speech. I have all the elements of 42 U.S.C., but I did not put the words 42 U.S.C. 1983 in the complaint. And there are, counsel cited the first case, I think, from this circuit saying that you have to plead 42 U.S.C. 1983. But those cases arise in the context of where a plaintiff is trying to bring an action directly under the Constitution. In other words, he's trying to say, I sue for a 14th Amendment or a First Amendment violation, but it's an implied cause of action under the Constitution. It's not a 1983 claim, and thereby avoid some of these Section 1983 defenses. Well, I made it clear that was not our intent. It was simply a clerical error. I mean, it's the defense, in a way, is where your lawyer's a buffoon, and they cited two other cases where I'd failed to do the same thing. But, I made it as clear as I could. We are intended to sue under 1983, and we'd like to amend to put it in there. And, Your Honor, as I understand how technical the federal pleadings rules have become, but I do not believe it has ever gone that far by the Supreme Court. I mean, as they're arguing that this circuit has said that you have to plead 1983. But what I'm saying, it's always in the context of the plaintiff is trying to avoid some 1983 defense, which we have never tried to avoid. We agree that we're suing under 1983, and it was simply a clerical error that I failed to cite it in the complaint.
There were no additional facts or allegations that were just a matter of putting in the statute number?
What they say it prejudiced them because they have to have discovery. Now, I don't understand what in the world they would discover. You know, we've taken everybody's deposition that knows anything about the case, and if they're saying it's like a policy defense or something, it's their defense to take their own agent's deposition. I mean, I don't know what it is they want to discover, you know, to put it in the complaint. But It was my error. It had nothing to do with any fault of the client. I just failed to put it in there, and I apparently done it twice in the past. I failed to cite the statute. Your Honor, let me talk briefly, and this is something that we talked about yesterday a little bit in connection with another case, and that's the Garcetti rule under the First Amendment, which the issue is, was her, while she's off, to just mention the facts of it, while she's off, within a couple of weeks before she's off, she's trying to get her child into this 504 Rehabilitation Act program, this program to give him special instruction. There's been controversy that about a year or so ago, there was a teacher reprimanded for taking him into the program. The superintendent doesn't want him in there. The superintendent's rationale, if we let him do it, I've probably got 20 students in this school that has the same problem, and I'm going to have to let them all in it. And the superintendent doesn't like it. And she writes a letter wanting to put him in it. There's also, I cited the wrong place in the record, but it's at record 805, where her husband did a affidavit about the contact they'd had trying to get him into the program. But we believe, Your Honor, that the distinction should be between that citizen speech, that anything that's not employee speech is citizen speech protected under Garcetti. The Supreme Court cases, as we discussed yesterday, always deal with either employee speech or it's citizen speech. Well, to me, this is if that's the distinction between whether a person is speaking as a citizen or as an employee, if that's the only type of speech we recognize, then this is citizen speech. It had nothing to do with her employment. They're saying that it's speech as a private person in a private capacity. Well, the Gibbon case cited in our brief from the U.S. Supreme Court said even speech privately made can be protected. And, of course, it's been made so clear by this court in the Fife case that, you know, advocating for your child is a protected constitutional right. It's a liberty right. And it's a free speech right. So we believe that Your Honor should give Garcetti a narrow reading, not a broad reading, and say that this was citizen speech, even though I understand it's private. But we just see no reason for employee speech to even come into it. There's no claim she was a bad worker or she's doing anything to disturb work conditions. She's an outstanding teacher. So, Your Honor, for those reasons, we request the summary judgment be reversed.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Wade. Ms. Morris.
May it please the court, Jessica Morris, counsel for the appellee, the Calhoun County School District. And I'll start with the ADA claim. The district court properly dismissed Owens' ADA claim because Owens was not qualified for her job at the time she was terminated. Therefore, she cannot make a prima facie case of discrimination under the ADA. To demonstrate that she was qualified for her job at the time she was terminated, Owens must show that she was able to perform the essential functions of her job at the time she was terminated, or that with a reasonable accommodation, she would have been able to perform the essential functions of her job. Owens can do neither. First, with regard to Owens not being able to perform the essential functions of her job, this court has held that regular attendance is an essential function for most jobs. Regular attendance is definitely an essential function for an elementary school teacher. Because Owen's doctor had not released her to return to work at the time she was terminated, she was not able to meet the attendance requirements. Therefore, she was not able to perform the essential functions of her job. Second, there was no reasonable accommodation that the district could have offered Owens. When the school principal spoke with Owens on February 4th, after her FMLA leave had expired, inquiring when Owens was going to return to work, Owens told the principal that she had a doctor's appointment on either February 12th or February 15th. She didn't know the exact date of the doctor's appointment, but it was one of those days, and she would return to work after her doctor released her. Owens had no way of knowing if or when her doctor was going to release her when she spoke to the principal on February 4th. And as it turns out, Owens' doctor did not release her during her February 15th doctor's appointment. Nor did he release her to return to work during her March 3rd doctor's appointment. And to this day, Owens has not presented any documentation showing when her doctor released her to return to work. Because neither Owens nor the school district had any indication when her doctor was going to release her, Owens' request to be off until her doctor released her was a request for indefinite leave, which is not a reasonable accommodation as a matter of law.
So you're saying the record, even now there's no release document?
Absolutely. There's nothing in the record to show when she was released. Because this court, other circuits, and the EEOC are all very clear that indefinite leave is not a reasonable accommodation, and employers are under no obligation to grant an employee's request for indefinite leave. Because there is no indication when her doctor was going to release her, the only accommodation that the school district could have provided Owens was indefinite leave. Therefore, there were no reasonable accommodations that the school district could have provided Owens. Now, the facts in this case are strikingly similar to the facts in Amsel versus the Texas Water Development Board, a case in which Judge King was on the panel. In that case, the Fifth Circuit held that Mr. Amsel was not qualified for his job at the time he was terminated because he had not been to work in 5 months. His FMLA leave had expired. His doctor had not released him to return to work, nor was there any indication when his doctor was going to release him to return to work. In this case, Owens had not been to work in almost 4 months. She had exhausted her FMLA leave. Her doctor had not released her to return to work, and there was no indication when her doctor was going to release her. Therefore, just as the Fifth Circuit held in Amsel, Owens was not qualified for her job at the time she was terminated, and therefore, she cannot make a prima facie case of discrimination under the ADA.
The facts that are in there about her doing some work at another school district and possibly not intending to come back, and that her husband was going to move out of state, and are those relevant to this claim? I mean, were those taken into consideration by the school district in deciding whether she should be terminated or come back, or was there some thought that she didn't plan to come back? Or
Owens requested a termination hearing before the school board, and when the school board voted to uphold her termination, the reasons they listed were she had exhausted her FMLA leave, she did not give the district a definite date when she was returning to work, she performed part-time work for another school district, and she completed 6 hours worth of university coursework. And to your other question, the superintendent had heard rumors in the community that Owens was not planning on returning back to her job. She was looking for another career opportunity. And if you look at her medical records, which are record citations 182 and 183, they're actually medical records from two different days. Before she found out she was terminated, Owens had a conversation with her health care provider where she told the provider that, I'm having to make this really tough decision whether I'm going to resign from the district or return back to the classroom to teach. And then after Owens was terminated, she had another conversation with her health care provider where she told the provider, I'm actually glad that I received this termination notice because now I do not have to make the decision about turning in my resignation notice. So that was definitely going on. That was definitely in the air during the time Owens was terminated. And back to the allegations that Owens raises on appeal. For the first time on appeal, Owens argues that the district violated the ADA because it allegedly failed to engage in the interactive process. Because Owens did not raise this issue on summary judgment, she has waived her right to raise it on appeal. But even assuming that she did not waive her right to raise this issue, this court, the Fifth Circuit, has held that an employer violates the ADA only if the failure to engage in the interactive process leads to a failure to reasonably accommodate. Given the undisputed facts of this case, other than providing Owens indefinite leave, which is not a reasonable accommodation, there were no other accommodations that the district could have provided Owens because her doctor had not released her to return to work, and there was no indication when he was going to release her to return to work. The alleged failure to engage in the interactive process could not have led to a failure to reasonably accommodate since there were no reasonable accommodations that the district could have offered her. And the next issue I want to move to is the First Amendment claim.
Before you move there, let me just and be clear. What was the, I know she was being treated by a neurosurgeon, so specifically what was the medical impediment? And then was it that she couldn't stand or sit or lift or what?
Owens contends that she had chronic back pain for probably 15 years and then to the fall of 2009, her back started hurting again, and this time it was just a lot different than it had been in the past. So her primary care physician referred her to a neurosurgeon who recommended both back and neck surgery. And so she had neck surgery in the fall of 2009, and then 6 weeks later, maybe in December 2009, she had the second surgery. And one other point about the on the ADA, Owens also alleges that the district violated the ADA because it had a 100% healed rule. Again, Owens did not raise this issue during summary judgment, so she's waived it. However, if you take a look at the termination letter that the superintendent wrote to Owens, the superintendent specifically told Owens, please feel free to apply for open positions after your doctor has released you with or without restrictions. The fact that the superintendent told Owens that she could apply for open positions after her doctor after her doctor released her, even with restrictions, goes to show that the school district did not have a 100% healed rule. And moving on to the First Amendment issue. The district court properly dismissed Owens' First Amendment issue because Owens spoke on a matter of private concern, therefore her speech was not protected by the First Amendment. The threshold issue is whether Owens spoke on a matter of public or private concern when she requested academic assistance for her child. If a public employee speaks on a matter of private concern, then that speech is not protected by the First Amendment. This court has held that whether speech is on a matter of public or private concern is a legal question for the court to decide, and this court has also held that matters of public concern are those matters that relate to political, social, or other concerns to the community. The speech at issue in this case was the letter Owens wrote to the district's teacher support team requesting academic assistance for her child, and the telephone call that Owens made to the Mississippi Department of Education also requesting academic assistance for her child. Owens spoke purely on a matter of private concern when she requested these academic assistance for her child because this was strictly a personal matter that only concerned Owens and her son. Similarly, in Harris versus Pontotoc County School District, another case in which Judge King was on the panel, the Fifth Circuit held that Mrs. Harris spoke on a matter of private concern that Mrs. Harris was employed by the school district where her child was enrolled, and Mrs. Harris spoke on a matter of private concern when she advocated for her own child's education. And therefore,
regardless of whether it was private or public speech, it's still the position of the school district that this wasn't the grounds for the termination.
That's absolutely correct. Right? That's our position, that her speech played no role in the decision to terminate her. So just like this court decided in the Harris case, Owens spoke on a matter of private concern, and therefore her speech is not protected by the First Amendment. During summary judgment, Owens' entire First Amendment argument centered on her assertion that she spoke on a matter of public concern and that her interest in speaking on this matter of public concern outweighed the school district's interest in promoting efficiency. But interestingly, on appeal, Owens no longer asserts that she spoke on a matter of public concern. She's completely abandoned that argument. And since she's abandoned that argument, this court should affirm the district court's decision that she spoke on a matter of private concern. Now, Owens argues for the first time on appeal that her speech should be protected by the First Amendment because she spoke as a parent, and parental speech should be protected by the First Amendment because she has a 14th Amendment liberty interest in familial relations. Since Owens did not raise this issue during summary judgment, again, she's waived her right to raise it on appeal. But even assuming that she did not waive her right to raise this issue, she still presents no fact issues that show that her speech was protected by the First Amendment. Owens wants this court to carve out parental speech as this new category of protected speech. However, this case fits squarely within this court's First Amendment public employee speech jurisprudence because this case concerns the government in its role as an employer, not as a sovereign, and because the alleged retaliatory action was an adverse employment decision. Therefore, this court should analyze this case in accordance with its First Amendment public employee speech jurisprudence, where the threshold question is whether Owen spoke on a matter of public or private concern when she requested academic assistance for her child. Owens also argues that her speech is protected because her interest in speaking outweighed the school district's interest in promoting efficiency. Now, you only reach the Pickering balance test if it has been determined that the public employee spoke on a matter of public concern. Because Owens spoke on a matter of private concern, there's no need for this court to engage in the Pickering balance test. And further, in order to hold the school district liable for First Amendment retaliation, Owens must show that the school board knew about her speech and that her speech motivated the school board's decision to terminate her. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that the board even knew about her letter to the district's teacher support team or about her phone call to the Mississippi Department of Education. This issue was not raised during her termination hearing before the school board. Nothing in the record suggests that her speech played any role in the school board's decision to terminate her. Because Owens put forth no evidence that her speech precipitated the school board's decision to terminate her, the district is not liable for First Amendment retaliation. And one other point on the First Amendment issue, Owens argues that the Fife case is similar to her case. However, the facts in Fife are clearly distinguishable. Mrs. Fife, who was employed as a secretary by the school district, spoke on a matter of public concern when she decided to enroll her child in an all-white, segregated private school in Mississippi during the 1980s in the midst of a boycott of local businesses by Black residents in an effort to get the school district where Ms. Fife worked to hire more Black teachers and Black administrators. Therefore, Mrs. Fife's speech was directly tied to the political and the social concerns of the community, and therefore she spoke on a matter of public concern. Unlike Owens, who spoke purely on a matter of private concern. I rest on my brief unless there are.
Seems you and Mr. Wade kind of trade arguments about who didn't raise what in the district court. And I was up here quick reading the reply brief and the red brief, and it looks like each of you say somebody didn't raise something below. It's waivable. He says you didn't raise an argument about respondeat superior, but you're making it here. But I take it you're either not making that argument here, not relying on it, or what?
I'm not relying on that, and the reason that was not made during summary judgment, because that is a part of a Section 1983 defense, and we didn't make any Section 1983 arguments because they did not properly plead their First Amendment claim under Section 1983. That's why it was not raised below.
Okay. All right. Just want to be clear.
Any further questions?
No questions. All right.
I rest on my brief. Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Wade, you've got rebuttal.
Let me comment just briefly on these things about not raised below or whatever. The substance, if your honors would look, there's everywhere I turn, they're saying you didn't raise something. The substance of our arguments were all raised either in our brief or in the brief we did on rehearing, where we pointed out two cases I had not mentioned, the Fife case and the U.S. Supreme Court Troxell case. But there's a lot of authority in this case that says if there's no response to a summary judgment, you still can't grant summary judgment because it has to be shown as a matter of law, just a failure to respond. But in all fairness, the substance of these things were presented to Judge Mills. If you look at his detailed opinions, the two briefs that we wrote, I believe all of this is raised. Your Honor, if you had to put the exact same words and the exact same authorities before this court as you do in the district court, we wouldn't even file briefs. We just send up the record.
Well, I mean, it's evident this case is amply represented on both sides, and it's a vigorous pursuit down below, so it's probably not going to tail off on all that, but kind of come back to the central point. The school district says that this is not a factual dispute issue, as you've framed it for us, that should go to the jury. They say simply and plainly the termination was based on inability to perform work, to wit, FMLA days exhausted, no release from doctor, no release from doctor yet, and at that basis and the only basis for the termination, not the First Amendment, et cetera, et cetera. So first point with respect to, is it correct that she's never been released by a doctor?
Your Honor, as I said on direct, they fired her on February 9th. She didn't have occasion to go to the doctor and say, will you give me a release? The doctor, I think, made it clear in his deposition he's never asked that because, you know, you go to the doctor and say, I need a release so I can go back to work. She's saying I would have done anything to get back to work, and it's a factual issue because
Mr. Wade, now she knows she's going back to work, and she's coming down to the end on these FMLA days. Now, my question is, has she ever been released from the doctor?
All right, Your Honor, so far as the record goes, no, because the doctor, it never came up as an issue after she was fired on February 9th. The
next doctor's appointment was after that. After she was terminated, was there some rebuttal, or look, you fired me, here's my release from the doctor, you know, reinstate me, whatever. I'm just saying, close to the time you're saying, I mean, was she ever released in close proximity to the time of termination to where she was fit to do the work?
My answer to that, Your Honor, is no. However, there's no occasion for that to come up with a doctor because she was fired. I mean, looking back.
Well, I mean, it's circular. The school district says we terminated her because when she ran out of leave, she did not provide the evidence that I'm ready to go back to work, and in effect is asking for indefinite leave. They say, well, there's no basis for that. You say, well, they fired her first, so then she had no occasion to get the release from it. I mean, that's circle at some juncture. When was she prepared and available to go back to work?
Yeah, I don't know, because that issue never came up. Once she was fired, the issue about Did you give a release after? I mean, the doctor's asked in his deposition, I can't quote it exactly, but the issue never arose after she was fired on February the 9th as to get a release. There's no occasion for her to, you know, to get one. It would never come up as a medical issue at that point. You only get a release when you're going back to work, and if you don't have a job, then you don't request a release. There's no reason for him to write her a release to work if she doesn't have a job.
So when she was fired, there was no request for reinstatement, no pleadings, no filings with the district to be reemployed. Here's my evidence that I can do this job, et cetera, et cetera. None of that ever happened.
Well, she went to the school board, Your Honor, and told them that she could do the job, and then she had testimony of lay people that she was okay.
But if a person has been out with back surgery, any kind of medical, and you show up, now, an employer is just not going to let you back because you're ready to go back. I mean, any job, they're going to say, okay, where's your doctor's certification? Either because they don't want to be liable for you getting hurt, exacerbating the injury, et cetera, et cetera. So if somebody says, where's your certification to come back to work? I mean, how does that?
They didn't ask her for it, Your Honor. They never told her that. They never said if you get a doctor's release, you can come back to work. That's never told to her. She's written a letter saying she's fired. If they had said to her, if you get a doctor's release, then you can come back, then that'd be a different case.
Well, when she's on FMLA leave, isn't that the expectation that at some point prior to the expiration of FMLA leave, one is going to return to work?
God, to me, that would all be a factual issue for the jury about what would be reasonable under the circumstances.
Come on, Mr. Wade, come on. Now, if somebody's, you're a good trial lawyer, I get you. I'm side of where this goes, but, you know, we got to stay within the real world here. You've got somebody out with back surgery, a neurosurgeon's cutting on them. They're unable to work because of that. Okay, if this person is coming down near end of FMLA to get back, are you saying there's no responsibility, there's no nothing on the part of that person to either say, I need more leave until I'm released, I'm going to be released, something. So this record is just void, that's just kind of out there in space.
I'm saying that issue never came up either before the school board, Your Honor, or when she sent the release. That's all I'm saying. It never arose. And I'm saying there's a factual question about the reasons of it. Her version of it was they told her that she could see the doctor on February 12th and determine whether she'd get a release, and then they fired her on February the 9th. And it's, nobody raised this before the school board when they went before them as to where you're not coming. You get their reasons in there. Nothing has to do with you failed to furnish as a doctor's release. That's not in their reasons for firing her. Their reasons for firing her was you were out working somewhere else. That just never came up. So it becomes a factual question. Your Honor says, well, I mean,
what does the termination letter say?
Her termination letter? It says you're discharged. And I can't remember whether it has the reasons in there, but the reasons ultimately given were you were out working somewhere else and you went to this school thing. It was not that you failed to furnish us with a doctor's release. And her testimony was we had an agreement that I was going to be able to see the doctor on February 12th and see if he would release me. The issue that Your Honor's raising is not something that ever came up when she was in the process of being discharged. If they had said get us a doctor's excuse, then maybe she would have, but that never came up.
Okay, we take the cases the way they're presented to us.
Okay.
You know, I mean, y'all are good lawyers on both sides squaring it up, but, you know, we take the cases the way they're presented to them, we'll decide us that way, but we don't take the cases in a vacuum, removed from, you know, what we see in plenty of these cases, and just kind of the way they are. But, as I've said, ad nauseum, we'll do what we do. We'll decide it.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate your good advocacy, both of you, in the briefing and in the argument of the case. We'll decide it in due course.
So thank you, Your Honor.
All right.